Welcome to another new episode of Upstage Conversation. My name is Carrie, and this time I am here with my good friend Brad.
The damn Yankees.
Yes, and we are talking about the the 1958 musical comedy, Damn Yankees. Now, despite the name, Damn Yankees, this is not a story about the New York Yankees.
No, it's very telling, and also tells you the crowd they were playing to by the fact that even though the Yankees are pretty much tangentially involved in this story, that they still felt the need to use them in the title to make sure to get people in the door. Little Broadway bait and switch.
It's also based on so the 58 film is based on the 1955 stage musical, which itself is based on a 1954 novel called The Year the Yankees Lost the Pennant. Now, all of these stories are about the Washington Senators, really. I feel like there needs to be like a brief baseball history lesson here. There does.
And this would directly come into play because in many ways they kind of use the same template for Major League 40 years later or 30 years later. So
yeah, a little bit. Yeah. So but before I get into the plot of the story, the Washington Senators were an American League baseball team based out of Washington, D.C. from like 1901 to 1960. And then they became the Minnesota Twins. And then they were immediately replaced because Major League Baseball went through an expansion with another Senators team, generally referred to as the Expansion Senators, which after the 1971 season became the Texas Rangers. And then DC was without a baseball team for like 33 years. And then the Expos became the Nationals in 2005. Now in the story of Damn Yankees, you have a long suffering Washington Senators fan because the Senators were basically from the 30s until they stopped existing. Not a good baseball team.
Yeah. Basically in the tens, they had one of the best pitchers of all time in Christy Mathewson, and that got them, I think,
Walter Johnson and
Walter Johnson as well. Christy Mathewson also played for them, I'm pretty sure, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't think he did.
Are you sure? Or he might have played for the Giants.
Yes, he played for the New York Giants.
Gotcha, the New York
Baseball Giants. Yes, but Walter Johnson is one of the greatest pitchers of all time.
Yes.
The Big Train himself. But yeah, so like they won the pennant a couple of times. They won a World Series. And then basically from the mid-30s through 1971, they were just mediocre to terrible. Like they were, the saying went for a long time, Washington, D.C., first in war, first in peace, and last in the American League. And that was, I mean, they weren't good. So Damn Yankees is about Joe Boyd, who is a long-suffering Senators fan. And he basically is at home and the Senators lose another one, and he sits there and he says, "I'd sell my soul for Washington to win the pennant." And just like that, a businessman by the name of Applegate shows up at his step and strikes a deal with him and says, "All right, you know, you can help your team win the pennant." And so he turns Joe into a slugger by the name of Joe Hardy. And shenanigans ensue from there, basically.
By the way, Joe Hardy, a complete very like 1950s, 60s baseball name.
Yeah.
Like pretty on the nose, pretty on the nose. Yeah. And like I said, this film, definitely had some knock on influence for some other films, not explicitly stated, but obviously, there's some Heaven Can Wait, influence that would come later. There's some, Natural influence that would definitely come later. The Natural really hitting a lot of stuff on the head, with the exception of, you know, the deal with the devil part of it,
but right.
In a lot of ways, very similar. Yeah, it wasn't a bad film. Like I said, like anything with baseball, you'll at least get me You'll at least get me in the door. I will say for a musical, and this was a popular musical. It ran for, I think, 3 years on Broadway before the film came out. And they got pretty much the entire Broadway cast, with the exception of the lead, to perform in the movie. So, like, yeah. you definitely have, like, the best version of this that you can see, because these guys all did this for over 1,000 shows. Not as many memorable, like, musical numbers, though, as you would expect. Like, there's not as many... not as many bangers as,
no, as I thought there would be. I normally like to discuss what we thought our most favorite and least favorite songs in these musicals are. But even for me, I'm very ambivalent towards the music top to bottom. I don't think there's anything egregious, but I don't think there's anything that stands out to me as particularly good. I think for me, I guess the most memorable is Heart.
Heart, which is easily the most memorable because it's the most earwormy, and it's the most earwormy because just because of the high harmony from James Comeback.
A little bit of that, yeah. I think so. Heart is interesting. Heart is a song that I think any fan of any long suffering mediocre baseball team can at least sort of get on board with, where they're singing, they're like, we don't have any talent. Like, we are not a smart team. We have heart. You know, we play with a lot of heart. We're out here. We're doing our best.
I'd have to imagine that performance is pretty much how every MLB clubhouse was back in the 1950s.
Right, that's exactly how it was. Heart, for me at least as well, when the Nationals won the World Series a couple years ago, that was a song that sort of played in the background of the stadium a few times and was heard on the parade route and whatnot. So, For me, as a DC baseball fan, there's that. But yeah, like, everything is very middle of the road music wise. And I find that odd. Usually there's something I really like, and usually there's something I really don't like at all. And this is just like, everything is just fine.
Yeah, like I said, the only song that really transcended the musical was the Lola song. Like, that was, yes, pretty much the only one that you hear in pop culture. Even to this day, still, you hear it occasionally in commercials and stuff like that. But yeah, like you said, it was pretty middling as far as baseball goes, but it's still amusing because that just lets you kind of concentrate on the story, which was fine. Like, it was pretty good.
I mean, this is a guy who loves his team and just wants to see his team do well. And so, after striking this deal with the devil, Joe becomes the greatest baseball player that ever lived. And of course becomes this national sensation, because where the hell did this guy come from? Right. So you have this press reporter who starts digging and is like, can't come up with anything on this guy, goes to where he says his hometown is, and there's like a trial with the commissioner because she's sort of told, again, by the devil himself, oh, this guy might be this guy Shifty McCoy, who is a minor league ball player who washed out after taking a deal with some gamblers or some shit like that. But the other thing is Joe remains dedicated to his wife, who he had to leave in order to undergo this transformation into a young man.
Which I like I said, that's kind of the whole crux of the story. Like, you know, like the whole moral of the story is you don't know what you got till it's gone, kind of
right,
sort of thing. Also, Joe, like, being like 22-year-old, attractive, you know, slugging Joe Hardy, remaining faithful to his wife and doing anything to be near her. Also the most implausible part of this entire.
Yeah. So like, he rents a room like in his own house so that he can be near his wife and whatnot. So the Lola character is then introduced by Applegate because she is a succubus and she tries to do her job. She tries to seduce him in order to sort of get him to morally fall and then be more susceptible towards actually selling his soul. Because it's worth noting, and I forgot to mention, Joe, as a real estate man, remembered to give himself an escape clause in his deal with the devil. And said, you know, if I decide I want out, and it was any time before basically the second to last day of the season, he would be able to leave. So Applegate is constantly trying to make sure that Joe doesn't want to leave this life behind. Yeah. So is introducing various temptations to him throughout the course of the film. But
and of course, like the love that Joe has for his wife is so pure that it like turns the succubus to his favor, essentially. Right. Which again is bizarre because the whole first part of the film is like literally a song with all these wives talking about how they don't see their husbands for 6 months out of the year during baseball season because they're so obsessed with watching their club.
Right.
That they basically ignore. And it's amusing to see the whiplash to a love so strong that it literally is able to break a pact with Satan.
With the devil.
Himself.
Yes. So, but yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I do want to talk, there were a few changes from the stage show to the screen. Notably, they removed a handful of songs. They removed the songs Near to You, The Game, A Man Doesn't Know, and the reprise of Heart. Again, basically saving some time, because as far as movie musicals go, this is almost on the shorter end.
It's a spelt hour 50. Yeah.
Yeah.
It moves too. Like it doesn't dwindle, which is nice.
Yeah. So they did introduce a new song. The song There's Something About an Empty Chair, which is sung by Meg at the start of the film, Meg being Joe's wife. And then again at the very end, not seen in the stage version before. And also interestingly, never been seen in any of the stage versions since the film came out. A lot of times when film versions of musicals would introduce a song, it would then be reincorporated into future performances of the stage version. Not here. No. The choreography for Lola was changed to be a little less risque, sort of across the board. Lola, who is the character you see on all the posters in the bodice, I guess you would call it, and the high fishnets and whatnot. You know, she's, as mentioned, a succubus. So it's, you would expect her to be a little raunchy. Mm-hmm. And she is in the stage versions of the show, but they basically, the film producers were like, we cannot have all of these sexy hip movements on our screens. It is 1958 and that is sinful. We can't have that. So yes, they heavily altered Lola's choreography. Now, notably, they changed the ending. Mm-hmm. In the film, Joe basically ends up stuck. Like, he doesn't get to use his escape clause. But the long game being played by Applegate here is he is hoping that the Senators will lose to the Yankees on the last day of the season and miss the pennant.
Yes.
And that will result in a rash of heart attacks and suicides by the Senators faithful across the country, thus landing him plenty of souls for his own use. So Joe is unable to exercise his escape clause in the film, but then in order to create this this mass devastation for Senators fans, Applegate turns him back into an old man. at the very end of the game when he's trying to catch a long ball. But old fat Joe Boyd is able to make the catch
accidentally
anyway.
Make a catch, basically. Like, he stumbles down and then it just happens to find his glove.
Yeah.
When he sticks it up in the air. So,
and then he's able to escape the clubhouse and run home. And everyone's like, whatever happened to Joe Hardy? But Joe Boyd gets to go home to his wife and live happily ever after.
I gotta say, the newspaper printers in this town are among the fastest the fastest doers ever. Not only did they have like the disappearance of Joe Hardy within minutes of him leaving the stadium papers out on the street, but they also had the Shifty McCoy story went from source to print in 20 minutes.
Yeah. So in the stage version mm-hmm. of Damn Yankees, basically his time is running out to help the Senators win and to escape his contract with Applegate. And so Joe, in his last at bat, basically as he's swinging, mm-hmm. yells, "Let me go," turns back into an old man, and still hits a home run out of the ballpark.
I gotta say, accidentally catching the fly ball off the bat of Mickey Mantle seems more plausible than
than an old man hitting a home run.
Jacking a homer is a 58-year-old man.
Yeah.
Off a major league pitcher.
Yeah. Off of the 1950s New York Yankees, yeah. Nonetheless. Yeah. So at that point, you know, he still runs home, and then the Applegate's like, "But you were mine, like I had it," and then he throws a temper tantrum and he leaves, and that's the end of the story.
Yeah, what a weird the ending was rather abrupt, because you're conditioned to expect these like big like finale numbers in these film or in these musicals, and you don't get it here. Instead, again, the apparently true love is enough to break a binding agreement with the devil.
Yeah. Applegate offers him the chance to become Joe Hardy again and help the Senators then win the World Series. Because again, short baseball lesson here. There was not a playoff structure in the 50s. No. If you were in first place in either the National or American League, you just automatically went to the World Series. And then whoever won the World Series was that year's champion. So winning the pennant back then was simply being in first place at the end of the year. You won the National or American League pennant, respectively, if you were in first place.
It's amusing because, and this was actually true of baseball in general back then, there seemed like a lot more emphasis on winning the pennant than there was on winning championships. Like, it was mm-hmm. a big deal to win the American League. That doesn't really exist now. Like if you win the pennant and you lose the World Series, it's generally a bit of a disappointment at the end of the season. So,
yeah. So, yes, winning the pennant, I still think is a big deal.
It's a super big deal. I mean, it's one of the final two, but you don't right. really get a. I guess you do get a trophy for it as
you,
well.
You do get a trophy, and you get a ring.
That's true.
It's not as good as a World Series ring. But
see all the things that interleague play has ruined. It's diminished the it's diminished the importance of the pennant.
Yeah, ruins the allure of winning the pennant. Yeah, for sure.
back in my day, the AL and N only played each other in the All Star Game and the World Series. That was it.
And like 2 weeks in May, you'd have interleague play. Yeah. And that was it. But yeah, I mean, I appreciate the changes that were made from the stage show to the film. Mm-hmm. As you said, I think, you know, it's a svelte hour and 50 minutes. And it never drags. It's pretty solid in terms of pacing the whole way through.
Yeah, everything kind of makes sense. The only thing that that doesn't really belong in the film is the Mambo dance number, which I really feel like just exists to let Bob Fosse flex on everybody.
That's it. So Bob Fosse, who would later be married to Gwen Verdon, who is Lola. So it was, you know, Bob Fosse, iconic choreographer for Broadway, choreographed this show, choreographed a lot of other shows. I believe also directed Chicago. Is that right? Responsible for direction and choreography on things like The Pajama Game, Damn Yankees, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, which is last episode, if you missed that. That's my favorite. Pippin, Chicago, worked on films such as Cabaret, All That Jazz, all sorts of other stuff. Bob Fosse really just flexed on everyone with his soon to be wife in that Mambo number. Like, that's really all that's there for, is to be a dance piece.
Yeah. And it's fine. Like I said, it's a bit out of place on Joe Hardy appreciation night, but or Joe Hardy fan club night, or whatever the hell they called it. But
yeah,
it was there. It's also funny watching this film in, like, say, contemporary 2021 America. You see the typical, you see some racial tropes in there from The Devil during his, like,
Days segment.
Yeah, looking back song. At first, I thought it was, like, really progressive to have a female beat writer in the film, but then she immediately goes to goes to the female beat writer trope that originated when they first started actually having female beat writers of, oh, like, what are they going to do around all those naked men in there?
But, like, it's said with a layer of sort of sarcasm.
Yes.
I quite like the Gloria Thorpe character.
Yeah.
She's a lot of fun. I mean, it's a good film. For the sake of talking about the cast, I do want to talk about the cast. Again, with the exception of the lead, everyone is a Broadway original for the film, which I think is great. They recast Stephen Douglas, who was originally Joe Hardy, with Tab Hunter, who is a little more of, like, your blonde-haired, blue-eyed 1950s heartthrob actor. But I think Tab Hunter was good in the role.
No, he was fine. Like, typically in a role like this would usually propel you onto bigger and better things. And Tab Hunter was a venerable TV actor for most of his career, but he never really did. This is probably his most high profile leading role that he had.
As far as film is concerned. Yeah. Yeah. This is a guy who sort of did some odds and ends over the years after he started to lose his looks, basically. But I mean, he could sing and he could certainly act. You also had, as mentioned, the incomparable Gwen Verdon as Lola. The multi-time Tony Award-winning actress, Miss Verdon, known basically as much for her relationship with Bob Fosse as she was for anything else.
Which is a bit unfortunate. I mean, like I said, she's extremely talented, and you would hope that she would.
Yeah, so she won the Tony Award for Best Actress in a Musical for her role as Lola on Broadway. She also won Tony Awards for her roles in Can Can, New Girl in Town, and Redhead. She also originated the role of Roxy Hart in Chicago on Broadway. So, and I mean, she did all sorts of other film and television roles, but. Yeah, I mean, she's great as Lola. And then you have Ray Walston as Applegate,
who really starts out in dialing it up to 11 and just stays there for pretty much the entire
He really maintains that persona the whole way through.
Yes. like I said, a very mustache twirly style of villain.
Absolutely. Russ Brown as Mr. Van Buren, the senator's manager, Shannon Bolin as Meg Boyd. Ray Allen as Gloria Thorpe, the beat reporter, as mentioned. Got a handful of players and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And it's solid stuff across the board. Everyone did a solid job. There's not really a weak point in the cast or anything like that. I don't know if seeing this on film makes you want to see a stage version at any point, Brad.
I can do without. Like I said, it is what it is. Like it's perfectly fine. But it really kind of you go for musicals to get those really memorable like musical numbers that are really strong, and Damn Yankees just doesn't have it. It sacrifices a lot of musical prowess for just a rock solid story that moves pretty well throughout.
Yeah. I would be interested, mostly because like we haven't had one in a long time. Mm-hmm. The original musical, as mentioned, was in 1955. There was a brief Broadway revival in the mid-90s. There was an off-Broadway, another very brief sort of off-Broadway production in 2017. And that's sort of been it. This is not one that I would say all too frequently comes back. And I don't know that there have been really many tours of Damn Yankees.
Well, the off-Broadway one from a couple years ago, very interesting casting in that one as well. To put it, the Applegate role in the like revivals of the play have actually had some pretty notable actors.
Victor Garber, I think, being one of the more notable in the 94 Broadway revival.
Yep, he was in there. Jerry Lewis was in one of the revivals. Sean Hayes was in one from a couple years ago. And then the off-Broadway one had Whoopi Goldberg in the Applegate role of all people.
Whoopi Goldberg, who we know can sing. They gender bent the role of Applegate for the most recent off-Broadway revival, which I find interesting. I mean, no one ever said the devil had to be a man.
No.
But Maggie Gyllenhaal in the role of Lola, which is interesting in that 2017 version. Again, Damn Yankees, I don't think you could like necessarily transport the story into modern day. It feels very of its time. Mm-hmm. You would have to pick a different team, obviously, for the main character to be a fan of.
Well, be an Orioles fan these days. The basic beats of the story have found its way into a variety of different like sports movies.
Yeah,
that have existed since then. Like I said, I mentioned a couple that you can see traces of it in.
Yeah.
Major League is very much like this in a lot of ways. Like I said, it does. I mean, you're dealing with a hapless franchise who is made purposely bad by like a conniving owner who wants to move the team to Miami, and they inexplicably like go on a run essentially with a ragtag group of unlikely heroes to like everymen to kind of save the day for the city of Cleveland. So like you definitely have seen this main plot spread out, you know, like touches of it, at least in many modern sports movies that have gone over time. I mean, The Replacements is also in very much that vein as well. So
it's interesting now, like a decade ago or so, 2009, they were like, we're working on a new version of Damn Yankees for film, and we're casting Jim Carrey as Applegate and Jake Gyllenhaal as Joe. And I think 12 years ago, Jake Gyllenhaal would have been a great choice for Joe. I don't think 40-year-old Jake Gyllenhaal be an appropriate choice now, but I feel like Jim Carrey would still be a good Applegate.
Yes, he would probably do really well. This one also had, so like in popular media, especially around baseball, you see a lot of Joe Jackson apologists popping up over the years, which to me is like the epitome of like white privilege around the baseball scene. Like these people who advocate for Joe Jackson to be put in the Hall of Fame, despite the fact that he literally helped throw a World Series back in the day.
Right.
I think you see that here because Joe Hardy gets the nickname Shoeless Joe. Yeah,
there's a little bit of that.
So I feel like George Abbott probably in the Kevin Costner camp of Joe Jackson Hall of Fame apologists, which, again, to me is absolutely silly. There's a lot more woes from baseball history that need to be corrected before putting Shoeless Joe Jackson in the Hall of Fame. Also, Natty Bo signing. I don't know if you caught that a couple times.
Oh, of course I did.
On the scoreboard.
Yes.
Out there, which, you know, I appreciated. And realistic, a Washington baseball team would certainly have
a Natty Bo advertisement.
Back in the 1950s.
Yeah. I would actually probably have to cross-reference with my dad if the Senators ever actually had a national bohemian sign of that caliber in their outfield, because it's worth noting this was not shot at Griffith Stadium.
No, not at all.
There was some archival footage of Griffith Stadium seen here, but the film itself was shot in a minor league ballpark in Los Angeles called Wrigley Field.
Yeah, modeled after
not the same Wrigley Field that is still standing in Chicago today, but designed by the same person who designed Chicago's Wrigley Field.
Yeah, it has a lot of the same accoutrements.
It's got the ivy,
and the ivy walls, and all that as well.
Yeah, so I mean, to be fair, a lot of ballparks back then looked the same.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's not a huge thing. But you know, I feel like, not that my dad's ever going to listen to this, but I feel like he would get on my ass if I did not mention that this was not shot at Griffith Stadium.
Your dad's not a premium subscriber.
Dad is not a premium subscriber. My 70-year-old father, I don't think, would glean anything of interest from much of our premium content here on the Nerdpocalypse Network. But yeah, I mean, damn Yankees, I feel like unless you're like a baseball fan, you're probably not going to get a ton of I don't know, appeal out of this, but I don't know. I enjoyed it. I watched it when I was a kid. As my father grew up a suffering Senators fan, we in the basement, there was always this enormous movie poster of Damn Yankees, of Lola, just like in my dad's baseball room in the basement. I also think we have a couple of the jerseys used in the
film. Interesting.
I'd have to go back. I think there's a couple of the like the Senators jerseys created for the movie that are in my dad's collection. But yeah, I mean, it's fine. It's good. It's entertaining. As Brad mentioned, there's really not like a standout song that's either like super good or super terrible. All the music is just
it is perfectly
very
fine. Perfectly fine,
middle of the road fine.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean,
and like I said, for my money, it is hard to get much lower than I had to come from the last episode of Upstage that I did. So this was certainly a huge step up from that. And yeah, Damn Yankees, a perfectly fine movie. It was interesting. Like I said, this is the first time I had ever seen it, so it was interesting to kind of see the influence that it's had on especially sports movies, over the years, a subgenre that I, of course, am very partial to.
Yeah, so. it definitely has an interesting legacy in how it has influenced other pieces of baseball fiction in the many decades since it originally released. Yeah. So,
but yeah, like I said, a perfectly good film, and still, like I said, for a movie made in 1958, the basing it around sports tends to help make it feel a little bit more contemporary than it probably would in a lot of ways.
It's a pretty timeless story, much as it is very much of its time.
Yes.
But yeah, that's it for Damn Yankees. I don't really have anything else to add. I'm glad I didn't subject you to another terrible musical this time.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, if we can avoid more, well, actually, no, but those make for fun episodes.
Because we
savaged that film. It's not a fun watch, but Damn right. Yankees was at least a good watch.
Yeah. Thanks for joining me once again, Brad. My cat is throwing a temper tantrum because I won't let him into the room. But if you're listening to this, that means you are a Dense Pixels or a TNP, premium subscriber, which means you have access to our whole premium slate of podcasts, which means you should also be listening to The Airing of Grievances, No Time to Bleed, The Men with the Golden Tongues, and full episodes of the Look Forward Political Podcast. And thanks for being a premium subscriber, because that means we get to do more fun content like this.
Absolutely.
But you should also listen to our free shows, such as Black and Black Cinema, Coming Distractions, The Nerdpocalypse, and of course, the best show on the network, the Dance Pixel Podcast.
It's not number one in the rankings, but it's number one in your hearts.
Absolutely.
And you got to have heart, as we know. So.
Absolutely. If we've learned nothing else from Damn Yankees, we've learned that. Thanks much. I think our next episode is going to be on In the Heights, which is releasing after being sort of held back for much of the last year due to the pandemic. I think we're going to take a look at a brand new movie musical in the year of our Lord 2K21. And we'll be back in another few weeks with that. And in the meantime, thanks for listening. And we'll see you soon.
See ya.
Thanks.